It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. From rising tariffs to uncertainty over a new farm bill, Wisconsin's agriculture industry is facing some serious issues. But our guest says overproduction is actually what's harming farmers most. We discuss how we got to this point and what governments and farmers can do to reverse the trend. Are you a farmer? Have you been impacted by the recent trade disputes? How? Do you think the market will correct itself? Have you taken advantage of farm subsidies? Are you enrolled in crop insurance? How do you feel about those programs? Are you nervous about the overproduction in Wisconsin's ag markets? And what do you think should be done? 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, ideas@WPR.org. You can tweet us at WPR Morning. Three ways to get in touch this morning. Kara O'Connor is the Government Relations Director for the Wisconsin Farmers Union. Her recent op-ed is titled, Put the Brakes on Overproduction in Wisconsin Agriculture. Kara, welcome to the Morning Show.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be here.
You began your recent op-ed by writing that the farmer is the central cog in a system. Explain that, please.
The agricultural system, we can think of it as a machine with a lot of moving parts. The core one that absolutely has to keep turning is the farmer. That's the central cog on which all of those other cogs, the machinery dealers, the seed dealers, the veterinarians on the input side, and then on the output side, the processors and the buyers of commodities, all of those other parties in this agricultural machine depend on the farmer's wheels turning. And in fact, the faster the farmer's wheels turn, the more profit all of those other parts of the agricultural economy reap. The problem there is that those profits don't accrue to the farmer. And so we've seen in 2018, farm income is expected to fall $9.8 billion. And that's over last year, which was a decrease from 2016, which was a decrease from 2015, which was a decrease from 2014. We have a long-standing slide in farm income, and it's not an exaggeration to say we have a crisis in farm country.
That slide in income goes even farther back than that, doesn't it? Because I seem to remember discussions about some of the stuff going back into the 80s and 90s, how we weren't really managing our production for the benefit of the farmer. What is making it an even bigger crisis now?
We have a central problem. Take the dairy industry, for example. In the last farm bill, the 2014 farm bill, the federal government put a dairy policy out onto the road. I compare it to a car on the road without any brakes. So we have a systematic incentive for dairy farmers to produce more through a government-subsidized insurance program. And at the 11th hour, Congress actually removed the only mechanism in that policy that would have encouraged farmers to slow down their production when prices were low. And so the only answer that a farmer has for low prices is to just produce more. And so we have the really crazy specter of farmers losing money because prices are so low and being told by their bankers, we'll only give you a loan if you add more cows. In other words, if you exacerbate the oversupply that's causing prices to be so low.
So in a sense then, as you say, dairy farmers are sort of paying to go to work every day then.
Right. In 2016, 2017, 2018, farmers were losing money every time they sent a load of milk down the road. And what that precipitated was a really devastating loss of dairy farms. In 2016, we lost over 400 farms. In 2017, 500, and in 2018, we're on track to lose more dairy farms in Wisconsin than at any time in the last decade, over 500. And the experience of most farmers, almost universally when I talk to them, is this feeling of spinning harder and harder to achieve less and less. And I think for anyone who talks to a farmer at this moment, there's this feeling that I'm just working harder and harder and not making any progress.
So with all of these farms disappearing, we still have an overproduction problem. That seems to be a bit of a dichotomy. Is this all tied to the increasing industrialization of various forms of agriculture?
The core problem is that we have a failure of federal policy. In the past, we have had mechanisms at, coming from Congress in the Farm Bill that put some brakes on oversupply, either by setting a base price or a floor price that diminishes when supply is supply exceeds profitable demand on the market, or by scaling back on farm subsidies when the market doesn't call for additional production. We don't have that in our federal policy right now. With the exception of certain commodities, so for example, sugar beets do have mechanisms to slow production, cranberries. And this year we heard that there will actually be a percentage of the cranberry harvest that's destroyed in order for farmers to be able to achieve a more profitable price on the market. In other words, the crop this year exceeded profitable demand. Now, the other way to balance supply and demand is to not produce the excess in the first place. And we have a good example of that in the dairy industry, chicken and eggs from Canada. Canada has supply management for all of those commodities, and the result has been a much more stable price, both for farmers and for processors, and without a significant increase in price for consumers. So we steady out the highs and lows and make that the uncertainties of farming already has a lot of uncertainties, but if we can remove one, that is the wild swings in prices, then farmers are only left to deal with the vagaries of weather and sunshine and rain. And we can do that, and it's frustrating, I think, for a lot of the farmers that I talk to that Congress has not done that.
Why is that? Why is federal farm policy not being responsive to farmers? Who is it being responsive to?
Well, if we go back to thinking about that machine with all of those turning cogs, all of those other cogs benefit the more the farmer produces. When a farmer plants more seed, the seed company benefits. When a farmer sprays more herbicide, the herbicide company benefits. When a farmer milks more cows, the artificial insemination companies, the veterinarians, all benefit, the dairy nutritionists. It's only the farmer that is losing out because the market is flooded. And so, unfortunately, in the United States, we have some of those very powerful agribusiness interests lobbying against any kind of breaks, lobbying against any kind of supply management or mechanism that would balance supply and demand, because frankly, there are some very powerful interests that are benefiting from overproduction.
We're talking with Kara O'Connor, the Government Relations Director for the Wisconsin Farmers Union, about overproduction in agriculture and the problem that that causes for Wisconsin farmers. Her recent op-ed is titled, Put the Brakes on Overproduction in Wisconsin Agriculture. She stays with us as our conversation continues. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Are you a farmer who's facing problems due to overproduction? Share your story with us at 800-642-1234. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. We'll be right back. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. Wisconsin's ag industry faces many challenges these days, from trade wars to uncertainty about a new farm bill. But the answer to the question of what's hurting farmers the most isn't tariffs or the farm bill. According to our guest this morning, it's overproduction. Are you a farmer? How have you been impacted by the recent trade disputes? Are you hoping the market corrects itself? Have you taken advantage of farm subsidies? Are you enrolled in crop insurance? And how do you feel about those programs? Are you nervous about the overproduction in Wisconsin's ag sector? What do you think should be done? 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Kara O'Connor is the Government Relations Director for the Wisconsin Farmers Union. Her recent op-ed is titled, Put the Brakes on Overproduction in Wisconsin Agriculture. Kara, we have full phones right now, so let's take some calls. Owen is with us from Wauwega. Owen, welcome to the morning show.
Yeah, good morning. Just a little bit about myself. I'm a dairy farmer. I work on a larger dairy farm here in Wauwega. The irony of this whole overproduction supply management problem is the larger producers that I know that own large farms say that supply management is it's federally not constitutional because it creates a government oversights that are far out of overreaching free market economies. The problem is this is the current agricultural policies we have now are the farthest thing from free market I've ever seen in my life. We are watching larger producers become very wealthy from government-subsidized programs, which extremely contradict the idea of free market economy. Laissez-faire means leave it alone. Let's leave it alone and go back to basics, where small producers and independent family farmers can afford to live and pay their own insurance and pay for their land and their equipment.
All right, Owen, thanks for your comment. Kara O'Connor?
Owen makes a great point. We do not have a free market in agriculture. And for better or for worse, Congress has been heavily involved in agricultural markets since the early 1900s. And so to say that we should leave it to the free market to decide would mean a whole lot of change that I think a lot of people wouldn't be ready to bear. The other important factor about our idea of free markets and well-functioning capitalism is that there has to be a referee to make sure that people are playing by the rules. And we simply do not have antitrust enforcement that ensures meaningful competition in agricultural markets. Since at least the 1980s, every administration, Republican and Democrat, has been utterly asleep at the switch when it comes to making sure that monopolies don't dominate the agricultural economy. We're excited, actually, as a side note, that the American Antitrust Institute is holding a roundtable on food and agriculture competition on December 7th in Madison. And that will hopefully spark a great, very needed conversation about how do we ensure that we really have a functioning competition in those agricultural markets. We don't now.
Hey, Kara, some of us, including the host, are old enough to remember farmers getting together and publicly dumping their milk in protest and basically going on strike over some of these issues, gosh, back into the 60s and 70s. What's happened in terms of how the farmers are working together to maybe change the move the ball down the field a little bit in their own behalf in Congress and in the state legislature?
We are experiencing a new energy behind behind an effort around fundamental change in dairy policy. We, as Wisconsin Farmers Union, launched a website called DairyTogether.com, and that's become a repository for information and a gathering place for farmers to learn more about these ideas and specific policies oriented toward fundamental change in dairy markets. So I would say the energy behind thinking in new ways about dairy policy and farm policy in general is higher than at any time since I started this work with Wisconsin Farmers Union in 2010. In March, we had a series of meetings where we invited Canadian dairy farmers to come and talk about their system of balancing supply with profitable demand. And we had an overwhelming response, standing room only crowds in those meetings. I think when you think back to farmers dumping milk, that gives you a sense of the gravity of the situation. What we'd like to see is that milk never having been produced in the first place, so that we don't have to waste it and we don't have to use the natural resources to create a product that doesn't have a home in someone's refrigerator. Let's be smart.
Of course, one of the other issues here is that America is engaged in some trade disputes that have affected Wisconsin's ag industries. The Trump administration put in place a farm subsidy program to try to offset those losses. What do you think about this strategy, Kara?
I asked some of the farmers that I know how that market facilitation program that was supposed to offset the losses of trade would impact their farms. And so they did those calculations. I'll give you a couple of examples. A 330-cow dairy farm would receive a payment that would cover the protein and mineral mix that they give their cows for 1 week. A farmer who owns 350 dairy cows told me that they would receive a payment of about $6,000. They're slated to lose over $300,000 this year. I should be clear that the trade wars didn't start this farm crisis. They exacerbated it. They were salt in the wound. And the trade war that has been precipitated under the Trump administration is also a repudiation of the central strategy that we've had in agriculture for 30 years, which is produce like crazy and we'll export the surplus. And we are reaping the bitter fruits of that right now. Mm-hmm. The alternative is exports aren't going to save you a decent price, will. And the way that we achieve a decent price is producing what the market demands.
Let's take another call. Peter is with us in Centuria. Peter, go ahead.
Yeah, I'd be interested to hear what your guest has to say about producers enrolling in programs like ERP and NRCS and practicing NRCS-like practices like the EQIP program, and how that might be able to offset some of these issues that producers are having. I'll take the comments off here. Thank you.
Kerry, could you explain what some of the acronyms are that we just heard?
The Conservation Reserve Program, CRP, is a land set-aside program so that those most vulnerable acres that are most vulnerable to erosion are not farmed, but instead put into permanent cover. And EQIP is the Environmental Quality Incentives Program. That gives, it does a lot of things, actually. But all under the umbrella of improving water quality and trying to reduce soil erosion. One of the interesting benefits of managing oversupply, dialing back on overproduction, is that you would achieve some environmental benefits at the same time. When corn prices were very high in 2013, we observed the phenomenon of farmers taking land out of CRP in order to farm some of those marginal lands and produce more, because if I never know whether the good times are going to last, I better cash in on high prices while I can. And when corn prices were very high, even the benefits from the CRP program were not enough to encourage farmers to keep land in CRP. You got more money by taking land out of CRP and putting it to corn. There is, I think, to the caller's point, if we had widespread adoption of some of those environmental programs, we could see a decrease in production. But it's going to take more than the money that we've put aside into those programs to dial it back. We have some good examples. I'd point people to the Dairy Together website for links for some of those proposals with dairy. The National Farmers Union also proposed a grain set-aside program that would have had a supply management effect, basically a signal to farmers to slow down production when the price is low, to not flood the market.
Wisconsin Governor-elect Tony Evers has mentioned overproduction in agriculture on the campaign trail. He has the power to appoint a new state ag secretary. What are you and the Wisconsin Farmers Union hoping to see from the new administration regarding state ag policy?
We will be looking for some changes that, number one, could give some security to dairy farmers. We're not far back in our memory is the memory of the grassland debacle, where farmers were given only 30 days notice of termination of their milk contracts. Other states have provisions under state law to ensure a certain amount of notice for dairy farmers. The state of Maine actually has a minimum retail dairy price. I think that's something worth considering. And consumers have consistently indicated in that state that they're willing to pay a little more for their dairy products if they know the benefits going to farmers.
All right, Kara O'Connor, thank you so much for joining us this morning. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Kara O'Connor is the Government Relations Director for the Wisconsin Farmers Union. Her recent op-ed is titled, Put the Brakes on Overproduction in Wisconsin Agriculture. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm John Munson. Stay with us. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. Acute flaccid myelitis, or AFM, is an extremely rare illness that causes muscle weakness and paralysis. The Centers for Disease Control estimates that less than 2 in a million children will contract AFM every year, but there's been an uptick in cases over the past several years, and there have been 6 confirmed cases in Wisconsin so far this year, 8 in Minnesota, 7 in Illinois. We're going to talk to an expert who will explain what acute flaccid myelitis is and potential reasons for the increase in the number of cases. What are your questions for our expert about this disease? Are you a health professional? Have you dealt with patients who have AFM? Tell us your story at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Dr. Mark Patterson is Professor of Neurology, Pediatrics, and Medical Genetics at the Mayo Clinic. Dr. Patterson, welcome to the morning show.
Yeah, thank you very much, John.
What is acute flaccid myelitis, or AFM?
This is a clinical syndrome where children will have quite sudden onset of weakness of one or more limbs. In most cases, it occurs after the child has had an illness with fever, typically within a few days. And although we don't typically confirm the cause, we think that most cases are caused by viral infections.
What are the symptoms of AFM?
Well, as I mentioned, John, typically a child will have an illness with fever, often with symptoms of a cold, less commonly with gastrointestinal symptoms such as diarrhea, vomiting, and then they'll suddenly experience weakness. In about half of the cases, the weakness will be in one arm, much less commonly in one leg, and then maybe a third or a quarter of cases, children will have weakness of one or more limbs. So they may have one arm, one leg, and other varying combinations.
Do children who survive AFM regain mobility, or is long-term paralysis a concern here?
Unfortunately, a lot of these children do end up with permanent paralysis of the affected limb.
And can this disease affect people of any age, or is it only in children?
In theory, this could affect individuals of any age, but the vast majority of cases have been in children under 10.
And is there a subgroup of children under 10 who would be most at risk for AFM?
Well, yeah, certainly any child who's immunosuppressed, either because they have a disease that affects the immune system or because they're being treated with drugs that will suppress the immune system, is at higher risk of such an illness. Although, when we look at the data from the cases that have been reported, the overwhelming majority of these are actually healthy children.
So how is AFM treated?
Well, unfortunately, we don't have drugs that will directly treat the viruses that cause the infection. And so our treatment is mainly symptomatic. That is, we ensure that children receive appropriate physical therapy as soon as that can be undertaken. There are some children who have permanent weakness in whom there may be surgical options. So you can actually redirect nerves to re-innervate the affected part. treatment is generally supportive.
Dr. Mark Patterson is professor of neurology, pediatrics, and medical genetics at the Mayo Clinic. We're talking about AFM, acute flaccid myelitis. It's a rare disease, but we're seeing more cases of it popping up in the last few years. We've had 6 reported so far in Wisconsin this year, 8 in our neighboring state of Minnesota, and 7 in our neighbor to the south, Illinois. And we're wondering about this disease. What's causing it, what's causing the recent increase in the number of cases, and just finding out more about it. Do you have questions for our expert about acute flaccid myelitis? Are you a health professional? Have you dealt with patients who have this disease? Give us a call at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. As I said, there have been 6 cases of AFM in Wisconsin this year, 5 children, 1 adult. In the United States, how many cases have we seen so far this year?
Well, this year there have been about 100 cases with acute flaccid limb weakness, and about 80% of those have been classified as confirmed cases, and they've come from about 25 states, so it's quite widespread. Where an organism has been identified, it's typically an enterovirus. And the enteroviruses are a big family of RNA viruses that are very common. In fact, probably 10, 15 million people a year in the United States will have symptoms related to infections with this virus. But only a very small number will develop neurological symptoms.
Is this something that's perhaps often misdiagnosed because it's so rare and not as recognizable?
Yes, I think there are a number of other disorders that are quite similar that can be confused with acute flaccid myelitis. For example, there's an entity called transverse myelitis, which is inflammation of the spinal cord that may be the presenting symptom of multiple sclerosis. It can occur in a related condition called neuromyelitis optica. It may just be a viral infection of the spinal cord that presents a little differently. Typically, people with transverse myelitis will have weakness that's symmetric below the level of the spinal cord that's affected. Another type of illness that can be confused with this is something called the Guillain-Barré syndrome, where there's actually an ascending paralysis or weakness of the limbs that relates to direct immune involvement of the nerves themselves. So it can certainly be confused with other disorders, and I have seen such confusion in a couple of cases.
So it's possible that there are even more cases out there than we know, but we just haven't recognized them?
Yes, I think that's certainly possible.
So the number of cases that have been reported and identified as AFM, are we seeing, is the number of cases normal compared to past years?
I think the way I'd put it, John, is that there's a fluctuation from year to year. Since the CDC began tracking this in 2014, we've had ups and downs each year. So what I would say is this year does seem to be a peak year. Why that is, we're not yet quite certain. But that's something that's being very actively investigated at the moment.
How long have we known about AFM? Is this disease something we've more recently discovered? You mentioned the CDC didn't start tracking it until 2014. How did we discover this disease?
Well, as often happens with diseases related to infection, this was tracked because of epidemiology. There was a cluster of cases that occurred in Colorado that year, and it was because of that that the CDC set up this tracking mechanism. This type of illness, of course, is not new because the symptoms are really essentially identical to those of polio, which fortunately has been eradicated in the United States.
Eradicated thanks to the Salk vaccine. Is there an effort to create something similar for AFM?
Well, I don't think there are active efforts underway at the moment, and part of the reason is that it's not clear that there's just one virus or one serotype of one virus that's causing this. There have been a number of different enteroviruses that have been associated with AFM, and I think, you know, one of the first steps is to be certain that we know which virus is responsible for the overwhelming number of cases, and that's not quite clear yet.
So is the increase in the number of cases that have been reported of AFM since 2014, is this something that people should be concerned about, or is this still on the whole something that's so very unlikely to be contracted that we don't need to really worry about it?
Well, I think for the overwhelming majority of people, they shouldn't be spending their time worrying about AFM because, as you pointed out, this is very rare in the population as a whole. I think as physicians, it's something we need to be concerned about. We need to recognize it promptly. We need to diagnose it as accurately and completely as we can and to share that data with the CDC, which is going to lead us, I think, to getting a better understanding faster. I think for most members of the general public, the important things to remember are the public health measures that we hear about all the time, and that is if someone is ill, try to stay away from work or school unless you need to be there. If you are there, you minimize your contact with other people. You make sure that you don't cough on other people, something we all learn as children. And most important of all, you wash your hands frequently.
You mentioned that there are multiple viruses that could be involved in AFM. So is this then kind of like tracking the flu where the strains are different and they mutate?
Yes, I think that's a very good analogy. The enteroviruses are a family where there are about 70 or so serotypes. And in fact, they're subdivided into the polioviruses, which are three different serotypes, which, as we pointed out, have been eliminated by vaccination. And the non-polio subtypes. There are certain serotypes that seem to be more common in this group, but like the influenza viruses, these viruses have a very high mutation rate. And it may be that that's the reason we're seeing peaks and troughs in different years, simply because certain mutations become more common, and that these mutations are more likely to lead to infection of the nervous system.
We're talking with Dr. Mark Patterson, Professor of Neurology, Pediatrics, and Medical Genetics at the Mayo Clinic. Our conversation is about acute flaccid myelitis, and we will be continuing that conversation in a moment. For you who are listening, do you have questions for our expert about this disease, AFM, acute flaccid myelitis? Maybe you're a health professional. Have you dealt with patients who have AFM? Perhaps you are somebody who is interested in researching this and you'd like to discuss more about that. Give us a call. Let us know what your story is. 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. You can also send us an email. The address is ideas@WPR.org. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. 800-642-1234. Dr. Patterson stays with us as the morning show continues. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm John Munson. Stay with us. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. Acute flaccid myelitis, or AFM, is an extremely rare illness that causes muscle weakness and paralysis. The Centers for Disease Control estimates that less than 2 in a million children will contract AFM every year, but there's been an uptick in cases over the past several years. 6 confirmed cases this year in Wisconsin, 8 in Minnesota, 7 in Illinois. We're learning about AFM this morning and talking about why we're seeing more of it now. What are your questions for our expert about acute flaccid myelitis? Are you a health professional? Have you dealt with patients who have AFM? 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Ideas@WPR.org, or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. 3 great ways to get in touch with the morning show today. Dr. Mark Patterson is Professor of Neurology, Pediatrics, and Medical Genetics at the Mayo Clinic, and he's with us to answer our questions about AFM. Dr. Patterson, you mentioned that this disease is contagious. Do we know exactly how contagious it is?
Well, I think that I would put it this way, John. Enteroviruses are very contagious. As I mentioned, there are millions of individuals in the U.S. each year who are infected but only a small proportion will experience the neurologic symptoms. And so I think there are two factors that are important there. One is the precise RNA sequence of the virus. In other words, does it carry a mutation that makes it more likely to infect the nervous system? But the other side is the host. So are some people more susceptible to developing the neurologic symptoms? If I can just expand on that, in the days of poliomyelitis, going back to the 40s and 50s, we learned that if you took, say, 100 people who'd never been exposed to the poliovirus before, of those, and expose them all to the virus, the vast majority would have very mild symptoms, respiratory symptoms or particularly GI symptoms. A smaller proportion may have a meningitis or an encephalitis, and only a few of those patients would actually develop the paralysis. So, you know, as with any infectious agent, the outcome really depends on the interaction between the infectious agent, in this case a virus, and the host. And it may be that there's something about certain individuals that makes them more susceptible to this infection. I guess the way I would put it, though, is this. It's not as if a person who has paralysis will spread the paralysis to another individual. The virus is contagious, but it's only a very small proportion of people who develop the neurological symptoms.
Let's take a phone call. Tom is with us in Port Wing. Tom, good morning.
Well, good morning. Historically, is this particular virus harbored in the polio virus? And my second part question is, worldwide, is there a place that we can pinpoint the origin? And worldwide, is this a phenomenon worldwide also?
Yeah. Thank you for your question. The viruses that have been associated with AFM are enteroviruses, so they're part of the same large family that includes the polioviruses, but they are distinct viruses. They are separate in their origin. As far as the origin goes, there's a lot of work that traces the origin of these viruses. I don't think we can trace it to any one place. They are distributed worldwide, and they're constantly mutating and changing. So it's not as if there's a specific locus where they came from, because they are ubiquitous viruses that are distributed everywhere. But amongst the work that the CDC is doing at the moment is learning about, as much as they can, about the molecular sequence of these viruses to try to determine if there are specific mutations that make them more likely to cause this weakness. And that, in turn, could be helpful in the future in developing more specific treatments for these illnesses.
Let's, Tom, thank you so much for that call. Dr. Mark Patterson is professor of neurology, pediatrics, and medical genetics at the Mayo Clinic. He's here to expand our knowledge about a rare disease that we're seeing an unfortunate uptick of at the moment, AFM, and we're learning all about that and inviting you to join our conversation. Eric is with us from Austin, Minnesota. Eric, good morning. Welcome to the morning show.
Good morning. Yeah, I just had a couple questions. My dad suffered transverse myelitis. He come down with it in 83, and he was been stuck in a wheelchair for 33 years. It paralyzed him from the neck down, but he did gain 65% of his upper body back. How closely related is AFM to transverse myelitis? And in Minnesota, geographically, where were the cases originated for the 8 children and what age groups?
Yeah, thank you for that question. Transverse myelitis is an inflammation that affects typically all the structures in the spinal cord, the white matter and the gray matter, whereas AFM is focused on the gray matter and what's called the anterior horn of the spinal cord. So in transverse myelitis, patients will typically have acute inflammation. Their deficits, the sensory and motor problems they have, are maximal at the onset. And then fortunately, there is some degree of recovery, although unfortunately, as in your father's case, it's often not complete and people are left with residual weakness. But there's usually sensory involvement, so people will have numbness or other sensory symptoms. They often have bladder and bowel involvement with transverse myelitis, and so that helps us distinguish it from AFM, which typically does not have those symptoms. As far as the origin, the cases have actually been scattered through Minnesota. We've seen patients from all over, so I don't think we can say there's been a distinct cluster of cases in our state.
Hey, Eric, thank you so much for sharing your story with us. Let's take another call. We'll go to Brookfield, where Charlotte is with us this morning. Charlotte, welcome to the morning show.
Oh, thank you. Hey, I have two questions. One, is there any pain involved? And two, do you think any of the shots that all the children are getting have anything to do with it?
Thank you for that question. Occasionally, some children will have pain in the affected part before the weakness occurs. That used to be the case with polio, too. But many cases are painless. Second, the question is whether or not we think that immunization is responsible for this. The answer is no. I don't think we have any evidence to suggest that. For example, there's been no co-occurrence, if you will, of immunization in these episodes. The evidence all points to this being the result of infection by viruses, which are either directly or indirectly causing this weakness.
Charlotte, thanks for joining the program. I appreciate you being here, and of course, all of our callers. Dr. Patterson, the CDC is obviously tracking this disease. We have people doing research and so forth. What other steps are public health officials taking, or can they take at this stage to help stop the spread of this disease?
Well, I think all the things you mentioned are important, John, and an important part of that is for physicians in practice like myself to ensure that we report these cases to the CDC and, if possible, to provide them with samples of either cerebrospinal fluid or blood so that they can further study these agents and learn more about them. I think that another important part of what they do is to educate the public about it. And the CDC has a very helpful website, which is kept well up to date. They also have a publication, which is intended for the medical profession, which is freely available to the public, called Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Reports, or MMWR. And that's a wealth of information about these disorders. And that's important for the medical profession, but also, I think, for the public to be aware of this and similar diseases.
Dr. Mark Patterson is professor of neurology, pediatrics, and medical genetics at Mayo Clinic. Dr. Patterson, thank you so much for taking time to talk with us this morning.
Thank you for the opportunity, John.
And make sure that you join us here on the morning show tomorrow. We're going to have a conversation about what's at stake for retailers this holiday shopping season, especially struggling retailers like JCPenney, Barnes & Noble, and many others. That's tomorrow morning at this time on The Morning Show. You're listening to this program on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Stay with us. More to come. I'm John Munson.